Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And in the background, you can hear the squalling cats of St. Andrews, is it?
Thomas.
St. Thomas, dancing on snare drums, and in celebration of something or another, I'm not sure what. Probably some horrific loss in some battle that the Scots had. The Scots are absolutely famous for losing battles and making great ballads and dirges out of it. Actually, if you stop and you try to think about any great battle in which you hear the bagpipes and the Scots are marching to battle in which they won, you have to really stop and think a long time to figure it out. Actually, the Battle of Waterloo is the only one that I know
no,
of.
No, there's a lot of them.
Yeah, but
the problem with a lot of them that they won, this is the big deal.
Yeah.
Is that they were usually fighting other Scots, which means that they also lost.
Well, yeah, but I mean, when they were fighting somebody else and they, you know, like when they would fight England, suffice to say that Scotland is now part of Great Britain, which shows you just how often they won
on that
one.
It is not part of Great Britain.
It isn't?
No, it is not.
It isn't?
No, it is part of the United Kingdom.
Oh. What is Great Britain?
Great Britain, I think, includes Wales. I have to look that up because I could be getting that completely wrong. But Great Britain...
But not dolphins.
...was the combination of England and a couple of other things. No, you're right. Scotland is part of Great Britain.
Yes.
The British Isles, the biggest of the British Isles is Great Britain.
Right.
That's not... It's just a geological and geographical thing. United Kingdom includes Scotland and England and... all of that. But
it's United.
Great Britain does not include Northern Ireland because it's a smaller British Isle.
But the United Kingdom does.
Yes.
Hmm.
Other places.
What would they call it if they ever got rid of the Queen and or King and got a constitution and republic? What would they call it? The Great Republic? The United Republic.
It wouldn't be a kingdom anymore, but the thing is, it's technically not a kingdom if you have a queen.
It's a queendom.
It's a queendom, but I mean, they change all the titles of the naval vessels to be instead. That's why they have it abbreviated. The HMS, His Majesty's
or Her
ship,
Majesty's, right?
Or her. So like, you don't have to change the paint, but I think they don't like the idea of changing the paint on the kingdom versus queendom back and forth. It's just not worth it.
It's worth thinking about it. I mean, it's one of those things that they may eventually, you know. Great Britain, United Kingdom may eventually get into the 20th century, but we're not in a big rush to see that, right?
As far as I know.
Right. Okay. Anyway, you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach, and The Personal Wealth Coach, this is our disclosure in case you're wondering why I'm rattling on about this, is in addition to being a radio program, which you may have deduced by this point, or an internet program as the case may be, it is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm that does wealth management for people generally of higher net worth, but sometimes people of not higher net worth, in Salado, Texas. Actually, we do it pretty much all over the world, but for American residents or citizens is what we work for. And let's see, what else have we got to say? We don't give specific investment advice on this show, and whatever we say you should not take as investment advice. We haven't said that in the past, and we need to say that.
No, we should say it more often.
We also don't get legal tax advice.
Well, let me explain why that is, because it sounds like we're up here talking to you about the investment world. What we mean by that is we're not giving you specific advice. And if somebody calls in and says, what mutual fund should I buy, we're not going to tell you, because there are a lot of other people listening besides you.
Really?
And if we say,
are you sure?
Well, you're right. It could be that nobody's listening. That would be far more likely on a Christmas Eve. But if somebody calls in and said, what should I get? And we tell you, and then there's somebody else listening that goes, oh, that's for me too, and it's not the right thing. So what we try to do is fill in the gaping hole of ignorance that is the economic world in the United States.
Well, it's a black hole, so no matter how much we pour into it.
We can keep pouring forever, and there's always more nothing.
As a matter of fact, I would describe the reason we don't give specific investment advice on this program, and you called it a show several times, by the way, just then. You're slipping.
It's
you're slipping.
Peer pressure.
Yeah.
It's something that we all fall for occasionally.
there's an old saying, I don't know how old it is, but I heard it a long time ago at a conference, and that is that prescription without diagnosis is malpractice. And when we give advice, that's a prescription. And if we don't do a thorough diagnosis before we give the advice, that's called malpractice. Now, if we were in the business of selling mutual funds or selling stocks or selling
We could anything, tell everybody to do everything, but there'd be, have to be a lot bigger disclaimer at the beginning, and it would be in at high-speed text that
you
nobody
put it
would
at
be
the
able
end.
To hear.
Please read right
the end. All that.
So anyway, we have a telephone number. We used to have numbers, but now we have a telephone number, which is part of the downsizing of America.
The robots are taking over.
Yes, it's far more efficient apparently that way. And it's 773-1400.
Local area code 254-773-1400. Right. If you're listening in Canada, you have to put a 1 in front of that as well.
So I tried to put the plus, you know, it says 1 plus the area code.
Right.
I spent hours looking for the plus on the keypad. It's like the any key.
Yeah, well, there's a plus on there, but you have to hit a shift.
On the keypad?
Well, not on the keypad.
I'm talking about on the telephone, you know, the keypad on the telephone.
Oh,
it says
right.
1
on
plus 254-94.
Oh, boy.
I mean,
they don't have the parentheses on the telephone either, or the dash.
Yeah, and I've noticed
that.
You've
got all these parentheses around the area code. There's no button for
that. Look, I can't tell you the number of hours I've spent looking for the any key.
All right.
And I finally concluded that there is a key on the keyboard that doesn't have anything imprinted on it.
Press any key.
That's the any key.
Right.
Because it just didn't write any on it. It's that really long, narrow one at the bottom.
It's a sad trick to play on people to tell them to hit a key that doesn't even appear on your keyboard.
That's right. And they do it so regularly. Anyway, you're welcome to give us a call. You can ask or comment about anything that has to do with the economy. Economics.
You can talk about some other stuff, but you will not get any kind of intelligent answer. Not that,
right.
That might imply that we would give an intelligent answer to anything else, which may or may not be true.
That. So what happened this week?
Let's see. This week we've had 6 days this week.
Okay, well, we're in the sixth one. We haven't had – I guess we're in the seventh
one. We're in
the
seventh day.
Well, it depends on how you know, some people think the week begins on Monday. I mean –
this gets into a religious conversation, and there are whole groups of people that will argue at great length over what is the first day of the week. I'm not in that mode, so basically I say according to the calendar, we are in the seventh day.
I like the headline that was in the Trader column in Barron's this morning. Dow gains for seventh week but misses 20,000. I think that last part about misses 20,000.
Yeah.
Now, I've only been at this about 34 years, but in every close of the market on every day for the last – that the market's been over the last 34 years, it has missed 20,000.
Yeah, you could do more than 34 years. You could go back to the beginning of the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
But that's just hearsay.
You could end every headline with but misses 20,000.
Well, actually, it got up to – it finished the week at 19,933.81, up 90 points for the week or 0.5%. 7 straight weeks of gains. The S&P 500 advanced 0.3% to 2263.79. That's good.
Before we go any further,
yes,
I'm going to take
further
a moment.
Or farther?
Either one.
Okay.
We can go further, farther, or farther, further.
Yes.
I'm going to take a moment to wrench my arm out of socket and allow you to do the same, because we should be patting ourselves on the back.
Oh, no. I mean, bursitis.
In February of this year, the market was down at 15,000, a Dow Jones Industrial Average, 15,600. And the two of us said we would not be surprised to see the market approaching 20,000.
By the
end
of
the year.
Yes, I remember saying that.
I know of no other people that made that prediction at that time. And now people are acting like they have been able to back that up with great...
Well, you know, we have been accused of being excessively optimistic.
And I'll agree with that. We have been accused mm-hmm. of it. But at the same time, I have to remind people that we're excessively pessimistic in certain areas. We're optimistic about the areas that we think are healthy. But this is something we talk about regularly about the bond market being, you know, we've been talking about the bond market being in trouble for a long time. What did you say in the newsletter that the bond market, the long-term bonds?
Well, there's no convenient, there's lots of indices, but there's none of them that I think really represent the bond market with good cause, because it doesn't have a central exchange and it's weird and goes off in different
directions. Right, and you got different maturities on everything. Stocks go on hopefully forever, but bonds mature.
Right. If we use treasury bonds, literally, 30-year treasury bond, as a marker of what's going on in the bond market. Now, the 10-year treasury is the benchmark for a whole host of things by the government, so a lot of people pay attention to that. But
you may approach the benchmark.
Right. There is the place I ultimately go and look is a mutual fund that shall remain unnamed. It is low cost. It is the most popular and one of the larger bond mutual funds out there. But it is, as far as I was able to determine, the largest long-term treasury fund out there. It's very low cost. It's very highly rated.
Okay. Fund being a mutual fund.
Right,
okay.
Mutual fund.
Right.
And it ended Friday down, I think, 19.8% from its high in July. On Thursday, it was actually down 21%. Now, the definition of a bear market in stocks is when something goes down 20%, when an index goes down 20%. The bond market, not being a single entity represented by a combination of the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange and all of that. The bond market being so decentralized and so fragmented, when something that is considered to be very, very secure and has mostly risen for the past 30 years, and in that 30-year period never, note this, never before dropped 20% in 6 months. I would say we have just seen this week the beginning of the bear market in bonds.
I agree. This is very clear in both of our minds. We're seeing interest rates beginning up in the United States. We're not seeing it anywhere else in the world, but here we've got interest rates going up. We've got good growth in our economy. Not that growth is bad for the bond market, but when you throw in the fact that interest rates are coming up and are expected to continue to go up for the foreseeable future, that's not a good thing for bonds if they're already suffering. Mm-hmm. Expect more. Now, there are certain types of bonds that shouldn't be impacted very much by this. The shorter duration. These are notes. These are mm-hmm. bills. These are very short term. And some of them are bonds on the label. They're just maturing very soon.
Right.
They were issued a long time ago. So,
well, even those I'm a little bit leery of.
If you're coming up close to maturity, it should be okay. But if you're really immature – if your bonds are immature, expect some volatility.
And this is we've talked about this a lot, and we've probably boring people at some point, but the reason we keep talking about the dangers in the bond market,
it's because we're not consummate optimists. We're just consummate optimists about certain things.
Right. There was an article in Morningstar where they said that the data doesn't support a bear market in bonds. And I thought, oh boy, is that ever a signal?
Wait a minute. The data doesn't – the bear market is not a
– actually, the data don't support, because data is plural.
Right. The bear market is a measurement. Once it's dropped a certain amount, then you're in a bear market. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what the reason is behind it. That's it. But if the data doesn't support it, it doesn't matter.
Well, it was the writer was saying that he did not anticipate interest rates to rise horrifically, and people tend to hang on to bonds. And he went into all this thing about history, and I just would be willing to bet he's looking at about probably 20 some years of history. Unfortunately, the bull market in bonds has now run for over 30 years, 36 years, I think, as it is, something like that. And when you have something that runs that long, there's almost nobody left in the securities business who can conceive of anything other than a bull market. And in this case, as interest rates rise, the value of bonds on the open market are going to fall. And if we get the Congress doing what it very clearly intends to do, and the president intends to support, the new president, which is borrow a lot of money,
then
we will see
rates, they have to go
right
up.
we will see a lot of bonds being issued. Now let me explain this. When you have a lot more of something out there, and a pretty constant number of people and amount of money trying to buy it, the price drops. If, as I suspect, we see a lot of people when they get their brokerage statement and their value of their bonds or their bond funds have fallen a lot, maybe around the end of the year, beginning of the year, when they see how much of the money they have lost in their bond funds and they start selling, then is when things will really get interesting, because not only will the government be issuing more, and I want to talk about that. We had an amazingly high deficit for this fiscal year in the federal government, about $500 billion. It's the first time it's gone up since 2009, by the way.
Yeah.
So here's the point. If there's a huge supply and very little demand for anything, the price falls. And the more it falls, the more people will want to sell. And the more people sell, the more the price will fall, until we are concerned that the system for selling bonds will be overwhelmed and lock up, and that will cause a panic.
Let's step back and talk about the fundamental issue first, because the concept of interest rates changing the value of bonds is very confusing to a lot of people. So I'm going to make this a much more simple situation. Let's say you have a house and you bought another house, or are thinking about buying another house, two houses. So you've got your first house, you refinance it, you go to the mortgage company. The mortgage company says, hey, you've got great credit. Good job. Yeah, you've done well. Let's refinance this. You get the best interest rate we can find because you've got great credit. You don't have a lot of debt out there. Here you go. Well, between that point and the purchase of your second house, you start racking up some credit cards. Like, debt's good. They tell me I've got great credit, so I'm going to start using it. Here we go. Let's get some more credit. And then, so during that time period, you spend a lot of stuff on credit cards. You've got one mortgage now, and you decide to buy your second house. And you go to a different bank. And the different bank looks at you and goes, well, your credit's kind of maxed out. That's not a good thing. They're going to give you a higher interest rate on that mortgage. And that means that you're going to have to pay more to get that mortgage, to get that second house. It may still be worth it. You say, okay, I want to do this. This is if you, in effect, Donald Trump or any other, in this case, it would have to start at the Congress. If Congress says we're going to spend a lot more money.
And we're going to cut taxes.
Their credit may be great, but if they're saying, in effect, hey, I'm going to take a job that pays me less, cut taxes, and I'm going to spend a lot more money, but I've got great credit, we'll expect interest rates to go up, because no matter the credit, your income goes down and your spending goes up. That's not good from the bank. Now, to get an idea of why, when interest rates go up like that, it causes the value of bonds to go down. If you're back to that example, you've got your mortgage, the first one, that's fine. You go, or you've got a lot of credit card debt now, and you've gone out and you got the second mortgage. The first bank's not very happy right now, because they looked at who you were back when you got that first mortgage and you had no debt and you had a good income. Now your job's not as good and you've got a lot more debt and you've got another big mortgage sitting out there. They're not real happy. So they turn around and they say, I'm going to sell this mortgage to somebody else, because I don't like the risk that I've locked myself into by giving this mortgage to this person. I was the first one to do it. I'm not really happy about it. Well, they discover something right away. The credit of the mortgage has gone down because the person that the loan is made to's credit has gone down. So the interest rates are up on those other positions because of the risk. It costs money if you lose it. So anybody that's going to buy that mortgage is going to buy it at a discount. The price has to drop for anybody else to want to take the risk that that first bank did, not knowing the decisions that were about to be made. That's what happens when interest rates go up. Existing debt, if you own it, if you've been making loans at a lower interest rate, nobody wants that low interest rate. Well, so you've got to drop the price.
There's an easier way, at least for me, to get my mind around it, and that is that law of supply and demand, I mentioned that on one side, which is the more bonds there are out there, the more, and by a bond we mean $1,000 worth of debt, the less valuable it is because there's just more of it. And the second issue is, and this is where I have a lot of trouble getting, when people have trouble understanding why their bonds go up and down. If, let's just say, you had a given bond and it was paying 3%, which is not at all unreasonable in today's environment, and a few years later, somebody has an opportunity to buy your bond because you decide you want to sell it because you need the money, or you've died and your children need the money or whatever.
Wait, you don't need it if you've died. You could.
I mean, you decide you need the money or you've died and your children need the money.
Oh, okay. All right. That's better. Yeah.
And they go to sell the bond. But the given interest rate for that maturity of that bond at that moment is 6%. Then the bond that you try to sell will be worth about half of what you paid for it, all other things being equal. Your $1,000 bond will be worth about $500. Now, there's a lot of complexities that can be thrown into that, but the bottom line to it is, if interest rates double and you go to sell a bond against another bond that's out there with the same length of time to maturity as your bond, and it's quite a ways out, then you're going to lose half your money. Does this ever happen before? Yes. It happened in the 1970s. And people have long since forgotten about it because there's just not a lot of people working in the financial world. And there's not a lot of people who own long-term bonds today who owned long-term bonds in the 1970s. Just, they're gone. I don't know where they went. They used to be all over the place.
I know where they went.
Where'd they go?
They went to a lot of there's, depending on your religious belief, you could have some further thought as to where they went.
There's a song about that.
Are you going to sing it?
I'm going to try not to.
Oh, dear. Ladies and gentlemen.
Peter, Paul, and Mary had a song, Where Have They Gone? Where Have They Gone? Long time passing.
Yes.
I'm not going to sing it, but they've gone to the graveyard, every one. And,
yeah.
And that's – so. And this is this is what we're facing. And this is, and the backside to that, and the reason I think there may be a panic, we've had bear markets in history before without a panic, and we've had them with panics. Bond panics are an unknown. They're being heartily denied by everybody that I know writes about this. But the big thing is that's different this time is that Dodd-Frank, the bill, which was certainly well-intentioned, had a combination of extremely low interest rates and the Dodd-Frank monetary regulation bill dramatically reduced the number of organizations, the number of firms that are making markets in bonds.
There's another piece here. The markets are fewer, and there are a lot more people involved in bonds that don't have a clue one way or another about what bonds are.
I would say that
amount of people involved in investment funds and in 401ks, in mutual funds that have bonds.
Don't forget ETFs.
And ETFs that have a big bond component, and they haven't a clue as to what bonds are doing in there. So they have a tendency to get out, and that's not good.
And now why do we know that? Because in the first half of the year, going into into the third quarter, there were massive outflows of dollars from stock equity funds, and there were massive purchases of longer term, higher interest rate bond funds because people had basically given up on stocks. they exited stocks and went to bonds. Now, that is the best symbol, the best indication I know of. We're about to hit a bull market in stocks. Now, the pundits said, no, we've not had a proper bear in stocks. It hasn't collapsed. Therefore, we can't have a bull market, to which I say poppycock. That's the nicest way I can say it. We had our bear market in stocks. It was 2008 and 2009, and we're just now recovering from the bear market. The bull market is yet to come. I suspect we will see the bull market get serious. Well, I think it got cranking in December of 2016. I think we're seeing the beginning, because now people are selling bonds. The same people, by the way, I suspect, that bought the bond funds earlier this year.
Right.
Now that they're seeing losses, are selling them and moving back into stock funds. So that's generally an indication that we've got a bull market going.
Another sign that it's a bull market is that people are talking about, we haven't had a good market correction in way too long. And that's a very pessimistic thing to say. They're looking around and saying, things are too good. It's been too long since we had a correction. But we had a correction just a few months ago.
We had one in February.
The Dow was down to the mid-15,000s. Now we're talking about 20,000. Yes, we had a correction, and it was a good one. It was a pretty long length of one for a correction.
And we had one in October of last year. So
people forgetting that are the consummate pessimists. If their voices are the ones that are the loudest voices, and they seem to be when you look at the news, then you have a lot of worry out there. And John Templeton said it very well. Bull markets climb a wall of worry. As mm-hmm. soon as everybody, all the big voices out there are saying, get out of bonds and get into stocks, then we're going to start calling the warnings and saying, hey, expect the stocks to fall. But that's not happening yet.
I want to make a forecast.
Okay. End
now,
of your
kinda
forecast.
It's kind of like the weather forecast. It's not a certainty, but it's a probability. I believe we will see the Dow hit 20,000 before the end of the year. That's next week.
Right. That's not one that I would say either way, because it's the short term is so fickle. It should hit 20,000. Mm-hmm. If you look at the valuations on the economy, if you look at the leading indicators, I think it should. But that's up to people who may or may not be rational.
And the reason I say that is not because of the economy, but because if you look back at the week between Christmas and New Year's, it's the reverse of what happens in the summertime. I think they have a different staff that hangs in there when the big guys go home.
Right.
And the ones in the summertime are told, sell if anything looks weird. And the ones around Christmas, because everybody is jolly, ho, 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 and probably have had too much eggnog, buy if anything looks weird. If you look back in history, the week between Christmas and New Year, and the New Year almost always produces a rise in the stock market. Not a big one, but a rise in the stock market. And it won't take much of a nudge to get us over 20,000.
There's a couple of reasons for that. At the end of the year, there's a lot of dividends and gains that are distributed, and a lot of people reinvest those. Another thing is that
it's called the Santa Claus rally,
right,
by the way.
People a lot of times will take tax losses at the end of the year. Well, if we've had a good year, that means there's not a lot of tax losses, which means there's not going to be a huge amount of selling going on. There may be people that have a lot of cash that want to get it invested before the end of the year so that they can look at it next year. And if there are losses they can take or gains, they can take long term. So taxes get involved here too. We should see a little bit of a bump. But should is deceptive, because there's a great book called Predictably Irrational. In order to be irrational, short-term predictions are incredibly hard. But long-term predictions on this kind of irrationality say that there's no reason why we shouldn't be above 20,000 on the Dow. It's not overpriced by any stretch.
And there's no reason we shouldn't play commercials at this point.
I agree, because we are capitalists. To think that way. Merry Christmas, everyone.
And this is the Personal Wealth Coach. It's Christmas Eve 2016, and we're going to play some commercials, and then we're going to come back on the other side, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise, and talk about other stuff. And And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And let's see, that was a, those of you who are listening on the internet or on the podcast won't have heard that, but there was an advertisement on there for truck drivers.
Yep.
They were doing recruiting for truck drivers, and we saw in the back of a truck on the way in to the studio.
Hiring drivers.
And that's a powerful indicator of something. And
it means there's a high demand for drivers right now.
There's a high demand for drivers. I read last week.
What's driving that driver demand?
The economy is picking up. Shipping is picking up. By the way, they've got a nice piece in the newsletter about the difference between orders and shipping.
Right. That you talked about.
I thought that was that.
We should spend some time just on that conundrum. But let's talk about truck drivers first.
I read I read last week in Barron's that one of the critical shortages in the United States economy right now that keeps it from growing as fast as it otherwise would is forklift operators. So obviously, if they're holding a recruiting event in Bell County for truck drivers, there's a shortage of truck drivers, which means if there's a, just like with bonds and stocks, if there's a shortage of something and there's a demand, the price is going to go up, which is going to make it more expensive for companies to have people in cabs. Now, the other thing, article in Barron's again today, but we've talked about it before, is this summer a truck left Boulder, Colorado and drove to San Francisco. There was a driver in the truck, but the driver wasn't driving the truck. The truck drove itself very successfully from Boulder, Colorado to San Francisco. And you got to, pardon me, but it's really worth thinking about the fact that they're advertising to recruit young, new drivers into the system, and they will train them. And at the same time, the first automated, well, it was 50,000 cans of beer were developed, were delivered from Budweiser.
Right. It was not the first delivery, by the way, by a self-driving truck.
Really?
No, it's absolutely not. There was a convoy of trucks Mercedes put out. That crossed the European continent with deliveries in it.
But it was the first one that crossed about half of the American continent.
Right. The you know, these big firsts happen, and what should be noted, and this is important. So this can tell you the speed of technology. DARPA does a prize every year, and their prizes are different than automation prizes. But for a long time, the big prize that DARPA was putting out was they had lots of teams from lots of universities and private organizations that would get together. And the idea was to have one of their basically driverless vehicles cross a large obstacle course, many miles of obstacle course, about 15 miles of obstacle course in the desert. And for a decade and a half, the prize was not awarded because not a single team crossed the finish line. One team, one year, almost, you know, it'd been going for about 10 years, one team almost made it. They were within sight of the finish line, and the thing failed and messed up. So the following year, every team that entered crossed the finish line. Everybody. That's what we're talking about. Each one of these different institutions and corporations and teams of people were using different types of technology, all technologies that they were developing themselves or borrowing from other people. And it hit the point where everybody could do it in the same year, where the year before, nobody could do it. That is what we're talking about with technological advance. When we have big events where we have Mercedes, or we have Uber, or we have Google do an event, and they say, all right, we did it. That technology was cutting edge and took many, many large numbers of zeros in the budget to get it done. And the following year, the budget numbers, the zeros start falling off at a very rapid rate because the technology is getting ubiquitous. It's getting so that anybody can do it if they're in that industry. Which means if you're thinking about going into a long-term career of truck driving, please think a little bit more.
And it's Or forklift operating.
Or forklift operating. Or for that matter, and this is one, if you want to be a phlebotomist and just take blood, think about that too. Because that's one of those things that phlebotomists are always in demand. They're extremely high demand. That's why when you go to the hospital, there's always a new trainee because it's hard to keep people in those positions. Well, machines are doing that now. They're taking blood and they're doing it better. They're hitting the vein the first time, every time. They're doing it with less pain. It's not going to be long before those machines, you just sit down in it. It preps you, takes the blood, and is done in the time that is still putting the tourniquet on for the normal phlebotomist. Now, that's not disparaging the skills of the truck drivers or the forklift lift operators or the phlebotomists or later the nurses and the doctors and the attorneys. In fact, it's the opposite. There's this great concept in all of our minds that there are people in that industry, in each of those industries, that are the best. You but know, John Henry was a steel-driving man, and John Henry was fighting a machine, and he lost, and he was the best.
To carry that out, to give some indication of just how serious this is, in 1920, we had about 41 million workers in the United States, and 5% of those workers worked on railroads. There were 2 million.
5% of the working population mm-hmm. was in railroads.
2 million people in 1920 worked in railroads. Today, there's about 170,000 people working in railroads.
And the population has grown mm-hmm. tremendously since then.
Which is so tiny compared with the percentage of the population. It's an insignificant number of people working in railroads. When it used to take actually quite a large number of people to move a train across the United States, including the people at each station, the people who prepared the fuel for the train, who prepared the water for the train, who did all the things that they did.
Telegraph operators.
Right. And now you have one person operating an entire train, in most cases, from one end of the country to the other.
Right.
Now, and at the same time, we've gone from carrying – and I'm going to get this. I may have the numbers come wrong here, but it's pretty close. Something in the vicinity of 400. I'm thinking 400 million to trillions of tons of cargo being carried by the railroad.
Right.
When 5% of the population, and it was a few hundred million tons of cargo, to the point where annually we carry trillions of tons of cargo with a tiny fraction of the number of people. And even those people, the person who sits up in the cab of the train, they have been identified as the number one cause of railroad accidents. Therefore, it's only a matter of time. Railroads, it's not like they have to do a lot of steering.
Right. That is true. I mean, steering is a limited feature there.
And there is a distinct art still there to starting a train up and stopping a train without tearing up the connectors between the cars and everything else. However,
computers know how to do that.
There are computers that do it.
It's just a matter of It's just a matter of updating the engines to run on a computer rather than when. This is one that's just got an email on this. McDonald's is going to put kiosks in every one of its restaurants in the United States. We're talking about somewhere in the vicinity of 14,000 restaurants. They're going to have kiosks that have the ability to order in advance before you get to the restaurant. You have the ability to just walk up. You don't have to talk to anybody because they're just pushing buttons anyway. You push the buttons, you pay your money, and someone delivers the food to your table. That someone delivering the food to your table is eventually going to be replaced by a little machine that comes out and delivers the food to your table. That's the reality that we're looking at here. If we're thinking about paying somebody $15 an hour to do something that my Roomba can do, my Roomba is pretty good at avoiding being stepped on.
A lot of people don't know what a Roomba is.
Roomba is a little machine by iRobot that vacuums the floor when I don't have to. Turn it on and it goes in. It doesn't do the same level of work. If I took my big vacuum out and vacuumed my carpet, I could do it in one pass. The Roomba takes three passes, but I don't have to be involved.
Well, I think there may be a variant depending on whether or not the cat is sitting on the Roomba.
Oh, that's true. The cat Roombas allow it to have more power, I think, somehow. It's the cuteness factor.
So what we're saying is that our economy is changing, and it is changing so slowly that we don't notice it. But here's the key. We've had a series of industrial revolutions. We had one in the 1830s. We had certainly had one in the late 1800s. We had one in the 1920s and 30s that we're familiar with. It was the primary cause of the Great Depression, one of the primary causes, if not the primary cause. We've had where, by the way, the biggest single issue in the technological advances in the 1920s was the fact that going into the beginning of the 20th century, the vast, vast majority of Americans worked on farms. Coming out of the 20th century, 2% of the population does.
And that's
because of the tractor.
Right. That caused, in the Depression, it caused a great deal of unemployment. But that unemployment caused a lot of innovation. If you think about the number of great inventions where the story goes, and he had nothing to do, so he was in the garage tinkering. Mm-hmm.
Which caused the next wave of unemployment.
Right, which causes the next boom, which hires a lot of people and causes unemployment in a different industry.
But if you talk to those families of the famous families that John Steinbeck wrote about, the Okies, who were working on the farms and then had to pack up and try to go find
California.
Jobs in California. And incidentally, the jobs they found in California were picking fruits and vegetables, which is what immigrant workers do today. And that will be done eventually by machines.
It's already happening by machines in a lot of places.
We've got huge changes occurring in the economy, and with each wave, they come faster. Now, the digital revolution increased productivity tremendously over the last 20 years, but it's slowed down now. And the next wave, this is what we're saying, is that we think the next wave is about to hit, and that is the digital robotic revolution.
Yeah.
It's already started to hit, as a matter of fact.
If you look at the fact that Tesla is able to make the vehicles that it's making at the price that it's making them, is because they've got very few people on their factory line. And if the large auto manufacturers that are trying to keep up don't change with the times, then they're going to be in a difficult situation. I think they're going to change with it. They are changing with it. But it also means that the age where a new company in that industry could pop up is back again. It was impossible to compete with General Motors if you wanted to make your own type of car unless you had budgets in the billions of dollars. Well, you can make custom cars now, and it's going to get less and less expensive to do it, which is going to put a big strain on General Motors. It's going to put a big strain on all the big manufacturers.
From an investing point of view, there's an interesting parallel, and I'm not sure exactly how to work it right now, but it's there. And that is that every major railroad in the United States was either at or near bankruptcy at some point in the 20th century. And the reason was, as the cost of hauling stuff dropped because of highways and trucks and so on, Congress effectively forbade the railroads to remove people from trains. It's called featherbedding. And the unions had a lot of sway with Congress, and Congress would pass laws saying, in the name of safety, you have to have a fireman in the cab with the engineer.
They're still having
when they didn't have a fire anymore.
That arm wrestling match is going on at full speed right now in France.
But it's going on in California, too.
That the government's saying you can't get rid of these people when the industry that's supporting those people can't support those people.
Well, what happened is California passed basically was it Uber? Yes. Uber actually had self-driving SUVs that they were putting on the roads in California. There would be a driver in there. They said, we don't have to do anything differently than we were doing before because there's a person sitting there ready to take the wheel.
Right.
The state of California said, no, you can't do that without paying $150, without buying a $150 permit.
It's not a big deal, and but having they didn't want to do it.
They had to have special inspections on the vehicle and had right. to be approved, but it was really right. going to put a wrench in there. Basically, they're saying, and you have to have the driver forever. You can't ever get rid of the driver. So they moved to Arizona, where the governor of Arizona, by the way, and the legislature issued an executive order saying, cool, do it here.
Let me explain that a little bit, because this is important to understand. It's really easy to look at that and say, hey, California is being stupid. It's not. Because there are a lot of companies testing driverless vehicles in California.
Mm-hmm.
Tesla has a lot of driverless vehicles. There are people on the behind the wheel. But all those cars have that $150 permit. Google's testing there. Mercedes. You go down the list of the big names. They're all testing there. Uber, in their press release, said, if Tesla doesn't have to do it, we shouldn't have to do it. Well, Tesla's doing it. If Google doesn't have to do it, we shouldn't have. Well, they're all doing it. It's a permit that says we need to know who the driverless cars are, even if there's a driver in there, so that we can continue with a regulatory update on when accidents happen. It appears, from my perspective, that Uber is just trying to get in under the radar and not report its mm-hmm. accidents. There was a picture when they started the program of a guy running a red light in an Uber vehicle that's one of the self-drivers. And Uber responded by saying, well, that was when a driver was operating it, not when the driverless was.
Yeah, one of the things – well, the other thing
is – but the problem with that is without regulatory updates, you can't know that for sure.
The requirement, if you get the permit, one of the requirements is the driver has to log every time they take the wheel.
Right.
And log off when they stop taking the wheel.
And
which
there's
is
a computer program that'll make that easy, but Uber didn't want to do it.
Right. And so – but I think we're also seeing something that, as time goes by, restrictions are going to be put on that. Maybe California wasn't an example. Maybe they are doing the right thing. But Austin's voters banning Uber from effectively banning Uber from Austin,
right,
was another issue. Where trying to keep the jobs, trying to keep things at what people perceive to be a level of safety, or perceive the whole issue. I mean, we just elected a president on the issue of he's going to save jobs and keep jobs. He may keep jobs from leaving the United States, but he won't keep robots from coming.
Right. And here's the big deal is that we tend to be looking backwards when we're making our political decisions. We look at the problems that we've just been through. This is purely human nature. It's not like we're coming down on anybody over this. This is just the way it goes. Donald Trump comes in on the premise of saving jobs. And there are places in the United States that is a requirement. It's really important. We need to get some new industry in places like the coal mines where they're just not digging coal up anymore.
We need to create jobs, not save them.
Right. Create a new industry. Create innovation. Not say coal mines can't hire or can't fire people. Because that doesn't work. And when Uber and Lyft were effectively taken out of Austin, what happened is that the taxi drivers said, hey, we've got to do background checks. We're commercial drivers. We take people around for money. Uber and Lyft need to do it too. And the city council said, yeah, that's probably a good idea. We should get everybody to have background checks. They passed the ordinance. Uber and Lyft say, if that happens, then most of our working population – which don't do it full time, they do it when they feel like it, are going to decide they don't feel like it because they have to go and do this thing. So they left because it meant that their drivers wouldn't be available. They would have to go and get a special permit and a special license and pass special tests when they already know how to drive cars. They don't want to be a full-time taxi driver.
And there's an argument against that, against the quote safety aspects of this, and that is who is licensing the drivers who have carpools?
Nobody.
They're hauling passengers.
That's correct. And in some ways, that's a commercial enterprise, and
it is
saving money on gas. Now, and this is where government can get completely out of hand, because they're looking at things and they have a way of saying everything is going to be the way it's always been. When it's new technology, that is certainly not the case.
You know, if they had some evidence, by the way, I guess, yeah, we need to cut out of here for
the hard break. Fox we got news and, news and such before we come back.
So you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we will continue more on this and some other things in the next hour. And if you would like to contact us
I got to emphasize this. You said we will continue more on, and we are being morons. So we will continue more on this.
We will continue to be morons on this. And other things we find interesting and the rest of the world probably is bored to tears over in the next hour. But this is Christmas Eve, and this is the Personal 2016, and this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And if you'd like to contact us during the week, we have real live people who answer the telephone at 254-947-1111. Or
you can reach that number toll free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and read our philosophy, newsletters, listen to podcasts of this radio program.
And others that are like ours.
Yes, you can email us directly at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.